You are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade policy. I am Sameya Keynes, economics and trade correspondent for The Economist in London.
And I'm Chad Bown, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington.
In this episode, we are going to celebrate the 70-year anniversary of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade.
That's the GATT, G-A-T-T, for trade geek people like me who really love acronyms.
Okay, so the GATT, what is this thing, you ask? Well, it's what existed before the World Trade Organization, or the WTO. It's the deal that essentially became the multilateral rules-based system of trade that Chad loves so much.
So today's story is the genesis of the GATT. So the story is going to be based on a book, essentially of that name, by three academics: Doug Irwin at Dartmouth College, Petros Mavroidis at Columbia Law School, and Alan Sykes at Stanford Law School. And you'll hear from each of them on this episode as well.
Let's start with the standard story for how we ended up with the GATT, this massive multilateral trade deal. Okay, so this thing was signed on October the 30th, 1947, just after the Second World War had ended. The world was in disarray. The representatives of 23 countries, they all met in Geneva to sign this massive deal. Okay, so from a trade geek's perspective, this thing was supposed to prevent new trade barriers from springing up, and it was supposed to help countries negotiate their trade barriers down. There was this really crucial principle that was baked into the agreement called Most Favored Nations, or MFN. And that was supposed to prevent countries from discriminating between trading partners. So the rule was, if you offer a tariff to one country, then you have to offer it to everyone. And from a political perspective, there was this idea that having more integrated economies would help to foster peace and prevent countries, or make them less likely to start killing each other. We will eventually get to the politics in more detail, but first, let's talk about tariffs. So the GATT was trying to squash tariffs, keep them low. Why were they so high in the first place, Chad?
The tariffs were high in 1947, basically because we were still lingering with the after effects of what had happened in the 1920s and 1930s. In 1929, the United States suffered a stock market crash, Black Tuesday, and essentially that's when the American economy fell into the Great Depression. The concern was then about American farmers and foreigners stealing American jobs. So in 1930, what the United States government did was to implement what infamously became known as the Smoot-Hawley tariffs.
And for those who've been following the current political debate, the idea that foreigners are stealing their jobs and so you need to implement trade restrictions may sound familiar.
So these Smoot-Hawley tariffs, they were relatively high, but they were also applied in a way that turned out to be very, very unhelpful. So these kinds of tariffs were applied as what's called specific duties. So they weren't applied in percentage terms, but they're per units. So rather than a 5% duty, think of a tariff that was, a 50-cent duty per bushel of wheat. Now that sounds fine, but in the Great Depression of the 1930s, it was going through a massive period of price deflation. Prices are falling. And with those kinds of duties, what that meant was a 50-cent per bushel duty, while it felt initially like a 5% tariff, as prices fell, it started to feel like a 10% tariff, and then a 20% tariff. And all of a sudden, it felt more and more restrictive, even though the U.S. government wasn't actually changing the policy at all.
It wasn't just America raising their tariffs. Everyone else followed. Some countries raised tariffs to everyone, including America, and other countries were more strategic about it. So they raised their tariffs to America and then cut them slightly to other countries. Effectively, what they were doing is they were creating these regional trading blocks, which from an economist's perspective is super inefficient. So Nazi Germany had its own artificial tariff-induced bloc in Central Europe. Japan had its trading bloc. But the one that was really, really hated by the Americans was the one that the British had. So they had this thing called imperial preference. Here's Alan Sykes describing it.
The UK also had significant tariffs, but a greater concern to the United States was the imperial preferences to countries in the British Commonwealth system like Canada and Australia, which discriminated in favor of those countries and against the United States.
These imperial preferences were a really big deal. It meant that if American farmers tried to export wheat to the UK, then they faced this disadvantage. Their tariff was higher than the one that the Canadian exporters faced, who got this advantage under imperial preference. So there were these tariffs. I should clarify that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs did not cause the economic calamity that was the Great Depression and the long time it took for the global economy to recover. But the tariffs did make it harder for everyone to recover. The bigger point for this story is that these high tariffs and the general protectionism, that actually laid the groundwork for a big trade deal to make sure that nothing like it would ever, ever happen again. Okay, so everything's gone wrong economically. We've got these tariffs, we had this depression, and then we get World War II.
And so GATT clearly is a legacy of World War II. The idea of the GATT was that freer trade would help to, after the war, guarantee a peace. Economies that had been cut off from trade, cut off from interacting with one another, just led to a system where everything was much more fragile. There was a strong appetite for a new economic system that would work. There was clear acknowledgement that something had gone wrong in the 1920s and 30s, and we needed a brand new approach.
The Second World War also created some really funky power dynamics. It essentially gave the Americans hope that maybe they could get one up on the British and get them to get rid of this imperial preference thing. The Second World War is going on. In exchange for financial help with guns and weapons and things, the Americans want foreign policy promises from the British. So the Americans want a most favored nation clause, so the end of this differential tariff treatment. They want huge trade liberalization. And they also want rules that would prevent the UK from raising new tariffs after the war was over. This was their proposal that they made to the Brits when the Brits wanted financial help. The Brits were not happy. So there's this guy, he was kind of a famous economist at the time. He's called John Maynard Keynes. So he goes to America in 1941 and he has a rant at the Americans for these lunatic proposals that they are making. So he did not like the idea of a most favored nation clause. Essentially, he was worried about the British economic recovery after the Second World War. He thought that it would require a lot of government planning. And he thought that control over trade barriers should be part of the government's toolkit. He was really, really worried about signing away the British government's right to impose tariffs. He was kind of an import controls kind of guy. Interestingly, there's this other guy, you might have heard of him, he's called Winston Churchill. He was the Prime Minister at the time, and he was a free trader. He thought the imperial preference was a terrible idea, but he had domestic politics to contend with. There were a lot of conservative politicians who loved imperial preference. These tensions were an idea of the kind of difficulties that were to come when trying to sign this big new trade deal. Not everyone was sold on the idea.
So in 1942, the Americans and the British actually do agree to something, and that is in exchange for this financial assistance through the Lend-Lease program, they sign what's called a mutual aid agreement. And what that is, it's a set of vague principles about what the future of commercial relations between the two are going to be after the conclusion of the war. And what's interesting about this is both sides had thought they had won. The Americans thought that the British had agreed to give up these imperial preferences. And the British, of course, thought, nope, we didn't agree to any such thing. We just agreed that we'll talk about it after the war. So clearly we can see there's going to be a conflict down the line. And at this point, what happens as well is that's when the trade geeks get going. They're the ones that start work on this potentially really ambitious and new international trading system, maybe even a multilateral trade agreement. And as a quick aside, the heroes of this story, they're not the political leaders, they're not even lawyers, they're economists. Here's more from Petros Mavroidis at Columbia Law School.
Now in the 40s, you have the superstars of economics. The UK delegation has James Mead, who for his work on domestic distortions, 1977 Nobel Prize in Economics. Lionel Robbins, a dean of LSE, one of the best known economists of his generation. On the other hand, you have Harry Hawkins in the US. Harry Hawkins is professor at Tufts. He has a very nice book which came out in the 50s where he explains the GATT. The GATT was not drafted by a lawyer. The person who drafted the GATT, John Leddy, was trained in economics. He was an official of the United States, but he was somebody who could draft in the way we speak now in everyday language. The GATT agreement, you give it to anyone, they can understand right away what we're dealing with.
Chad was so excited about the economists thing. Okay, so these economists were working. They were coming up with these bold ideas, multilateral trade agreements, deep tariff cuts, 3-year phase out of all quotas, cut in existing preferences and a ban on new ones. They all recognized that these ideas were controversial But they thought it was just best to strike while the iron was hot. There was never going to be another opportunity like this, with everything seemed like it was open. So we're still in the middle of the Second World War here, and there are these early negotiations on the principles of this new trade relationship between the UK and the US. Britain is still arguing with the US on imperial preference. They're bringing out arguments like, oh, this is sensitive politically, the close ties of kinship with the Dominions. And they're saying, oh, you know, maybe we could do something, but it will be contingent on the Americans lowering their tariffs by a lot. On the British side, some of the British negotiators are really struggling with maintaining the British line of argument. So James Mead, he says, yeah, I can kind of see the Americans' point. Imperial preference from an economist's perspective is just super inefficient and ugly. I should also add that these guys are having a great time. So there's this lovely quote from Mead that's in the book. So he says, 10 years ago at Oxford, I should never have dreamed that an economist could live in such a heaven of practical application of real economic analysis. It's like a trade geek's nirvana.
Now you can see why I'm so excited, though.
Yeah. All these geeks, these economists, they all agree in principle what this new deal should look like. It should have a bold reduction in tariffs. The most favored nation clause, the MFN clause, should be central. There shouldn't be discrimination baked into the deal. There is a bit of disagreement on how it should be applied, but at least the theory of what this new deal would look like was agreed.
And as you mentioned, though, there was some remaining internal dissent on the British side, even within the British government and even between the economists. And especially, I think, a lot of that was coming from Keynes. At various points in this process, he's described as being grumpy and a bit obstructionist. In part, I think he was quite suspicious of these bold promises coming out of the Americans. So we have to remember, the United States had never joined the League of Nations after the First World War. They were the ones who had implemented those terrible Smoot-Hawley tariffs. The Americans had no real history, at least in recent times, of following through on bold promises of multilateralism and economic leadership. Keynes was first and foremost worried about the post-war British economic recovery. He was concerned that signing a big trade deal was going to give away the British government's ability to deal with their biggest concerns, which was unemployment. And if that problem wasn't fixed, no trade agreement was going to matter. But eventually he did come around, or at least proved to be a little bit less obstructionist. He acknowledged that even though the government's hands might be tied, if everybody lowered their tariffs and kept them low, the benefits from that could potentially outweigh the costs. Seen narrowly, multilateralism didn't put Britain first, but more broadly, it could potentially benefit everyone.
So far, we have mainly talked about America and Britain. So they were the two big players, but the GATT wasn't a deal between just those two. There were other countries there as well.
Well, yes. To be honest, the haggles at the time were basically American and British haggles, just like happens on trade talks. That being said, Canada ends up playing a massively important role. And maybe we could throw out a question to our listeners here. Maybe we need a Canadian with us in the booth. So if you're Canadian and you have some great ideas about trade talks, send us a tweet.
Where did that come from? Literally, where did that come from?
I just wrote that in just now. I was just struck. So.
Okay. If Chrystia Freeland wants to come on the podcast, then awesome. But the filter is it's a thick one.
So the US and UK wanted a deal that would cut tariffs between each other. But they were also thinking about something grand, something very ambitious, and that would include lots of other countries as well. Maybe an international trade organization even, something that was thrown about called the ITO. The Canadians, on the other hand, they had an interest in just getting a deal done. They wanted to be friends with both the British and the Americans. They are geographically very close to the United States, obviously. But as part of the Dominion, they also had these strong ties to the UK. Here's Doug.
There's one incident in July of 1945 when the Americans were consulting with the Canadians about how this process of getting a multilateral trade agreement moving forward. And what the U.S. position was, well, we should get as many countries involved as we can, have it a really big deal, and make it a big trade agreement. And the Canadians sort of subtly put the brakes on this. They said, you know, if we get a lot of countries around the table, not everyone is on board with this idea of reducing tariffs and opening up markets. And so maybe, just maybe, you should consider having a smaller meeting with like-minded countries that really have an interest in liberalizing trade. And that group, that smaller group, should hammer out some tariff reductions and hammer out the text of a possible trade agreement. And that was really the origin of the GATT, as opposed to the International Trade Organization, which is what the U.S. was driving for. And we actually later, after the GATT, had an ITO meeting in Havana, Cuba, and it was a disaster for precisely the reasons the Canadians were identifying. That is, a lot of Latin American countries and India and others were really not in favor of trade liberalization at this time, and they really mucked up the works for the others that were trying to reduce trade barriers.
The Second World War ends. The Americans have been persuaded that they should maybe try to be a little bit less ambitious and they will achieve more. There are still really, really big differences between the countries. Britain is still just super reluctant to liberalize to the extent that the Americans wanted. America wants to scrap agricultural subsidies and keep export subsidies. Britain wants the reverse. At one point, the Americans just put a freeze on Lend-Lease. They cut off finance unless Britain will unilaterally drop its tariffs and preferences. So at this point, just bear in mind, the UK is still in a really precarious position. It couldn't pay for food, fuel, raw materials. This is a bold move by the Americans. It also did not go down well. Just the politics of it were terrible. If Britain had acceded to America's demands in those circumstances, just politically, there would have been a huge, huge backlash. So eventually the Americans back down and they say, fine, we're not going to hold you hostage over this. Let's go back to the negotiations.
So these negotiations were tense and super drawn out. Finally, we get to December 1945. And at that stage, the United States invites 15 countries to a party. So this party was going to be a core group of countries to negotiate tariff cuts. This party included the UK, the Dominions, and then a bunch of other countries like Brazil, China, India, and Cuba. And the USSR was invited too. Unfortunately, they never sent back their RSVP.
Okay, but the countries start meeting. The final two big meetings are in Geneva, which is where the World Trade Organization is today. Okay, so what they're trying to agree is massive. This is the mother of all trade deals. They're setting up principles that are going to last until today. But they're also negotiators. They are haggling. They're trying to protect their own interests. Britain is desperately trying to cling to this notion that it's still a great power. And part of that means keeping its imperial preferences. The Americans are dealing with really tricky politics back home. And Chad, there was drama. Tell us about the drama.
So one of the dramas that almost kills the entire deal involved, wait for it, raw wool. So the sides are haggling over lots and lots of different types of products. And of all of them, the American delegation has no power, no authority to actually cut tariffs on raw wool. In fact, back home, the Republican Congress was trying to pass legislation to actually impose tighter trade restrictions on wool. Now, Australians at that time had a lot of sheep.
I think they still do. So I actually Googled this. There are more than 3,000 sheep per 1,000 people in Australia in 2014, according to a website called jetpunk.com. And that's the third highest in the world after Mongolia and New Zealand.
Yeah, so I think they had a lot of sheep in 1947, too. And that was clearly their main interest. But faced with the American resistance to dropping their wool tariffs, the Australians basically just threatened to walk out.
It might seem funny that the Australians had the power to just completely destroy the whole thing, but they were a key player. So if Australia had walked out, then they probably would have taken the UK and the rest of the Commonwealth with them.
So the Americans are really worried. So what they do is their negotiators rush home and they demand an audience with the American president, Harry Truman. So they get their meeting with the president, and not only do they get him to veto that legislation that would have raised the tariffs on raw wool, but he gives them the authority to offer to cut the tariffs even lower, even up to 25%. This saves the day at that stage of the negotiations.
Well, hey, okay, awesome. So, wool, great. So the deal finally gets signed. On October the 30th, 1947, the GATT is born. Okay, so Chad, give me some numbers. How much were tariffs cut?
So here's Doug talking about a piece of research that he and I actually did together.
Well, unlike today when we have a lot of databases on tariffs and it's fairly transparent and it's published by WTO and by national authorities, trying to figure out how high tariffs were back in the late 1940s is actually a very difficult exercise. And there was the view out there that tariffs were very high, about 40% or so. It's this apocryphal story that no one could really trace out in terms of where they got the information or where it came from. And when we looked at it in more detail, we saw for most Western European countries in the United States, the average tariff was more like 22%. So not the 40% that had been floating around, but almost half that. Now, this is still very important because First of all, that's not a particularly low tariff, and it allows us to benchmark how important the first initial tariff cuts were in the GATT rounds. And they were, once again, fairly significant, but it's not coming down from a 40% height. The other thing that should be pointed out is that tariffs weren't necessarily the full binding constraint on trade during this period. There's still a lot of exchange controls and other limitations on trade.
And since this is my paper as well, I'll give you the punchline. With all the caveats that Doug mentioned, our best guess is that the first round of GATT negotiations cut tariffs from an average of 22% to 17%, or about 5 percentage points. But what Doug is also confirming is that this tariff cutting of the GATT in 1947 was only a small piece of what this new framework actually accomplished. So what's cool is this new GATT agreement also sets up a framework and rules for governing multilateral trade from that point forward. So what it does is it converts all these other border barriers that Doug had talked about, these foreign exchange controls, quantitative restrictions or quotas, tries to convert all of those things into tariffs. And then it sets up a framework for future negotiating rounds to reduce those tariffs over time.
So that's interesting. So basically, these other border controls were harder to quantify. If they're turned into tariffs, then they're clearer and they're easier to haggle down and barter in future negotiations.
That's exactly right. It also sets up some principles like this very important one about non-discrimination or the MFN clause. It creates a basic forum for how countries could settle disputes, bilateral spats between one another. Some other rules for transparency. So if you're going to change any of your policies, you have to tell the rest of the world about it so they can see that it's happened. And finally, and Soumaya, this is going to be your favorite, the GATT created loads of exceptions.
The exceptions were for tariffs outside of the ones that were negotiated in the main agreement.
Anti-dumping, countervailing duties, safeguards, even the national security exemption, all of these things that we're hearing about today. The original GATT allowed for these things to be possible. I went back to Petros to ask him whether he thought this 1947 GATT was a success or not.
And the best proof of their success, it stayed the course of life for 70 years. Actually, the GATT is still alive because the GATT is part of the WTO. And the GATT provided the recipe for a number of agreements that are WTO-covered agreements nowadays.
Oh, you guys with your multilateralism lovin's. So all of this is agreed, bring out the champagne, and most favored nations, that principle of non-discrimination is baked into this thing. So presumably that also meant that imperial preference was gone?
Nope, the Brits didn't give in. The Americans finally caved and just gave up. The Americans wanted this deal so badly, they were really worried that if they didn't get a deal, the UK would just retreat and go back into this Sterling bloc. The British had this outside option. But interestingly enough, even though it almost killed the deal at the time, economically it really didn't matter all that much. Again, here's Doug Irwin.
Well, the big logjam at the first GATT negotiation in Geneva in 1947 was the U.S. insistence that Britain get rid of its imperial preferences. And Britain adamantly refused to do so for various reasons, not just diplomatic relations with their former colonies, but it was embedded in the British economic system to some extent, and they were just very resistant to changing them. And the conference almost collapsed over precisely this issue, Britain's refusal to change its imperial preferences. And there's some memos where the U.S. lead U.S. negotiator, Will Clayton, was saying, we should pull out. They're not giving up enough. This is a failure. And fortunately, he was overruled by his superiors at the State Department, who said, no, even if it's an imperfect agreement, we should go ahead with it. But what's sort of ironic about this is despite all the angst over imperial preferences, within about 10 years or so, they really didn't matter all that much. They'd come down naturally because a lot of the preferences were specified in terms of these specific duties. A specific duty is a specific dollar or pound amount per imported quantity. And because there was a lot of inflation in the late 1940s and 1950s, the margins just became, in percentage terms, much, much lower and not really a bother in terms of international trade. So it's odd that the first agreement almost collapsed over imperial preferences, yet in 10 years, for reasons having nothing to do with the negotiations themselves, imperial preferences really weren't an issue at all.
So just like we saw earlier that the deflation of the early 1930s made the Smoot-Hawley tariffs even more restrictive, they became even more important. The reverse happened after the Second World War. The inflation made the imperial preference just much less of a big deal. It was fine, but kind of by accident. Great. Okay, so 70 years on, is it a happy anniversary for you, Chad?
Well, obviously, I love the GATT, but it isn't a happy anniversary. There are real challenges today facing the organization that are due to things like China. How do you integrate a major non-market economy into the system? But maybe even more worrisome is that the traditional leadership shown by the Americans is waning. In the age of Trump, even American support for the multilateral system is under threat.
Ah, Chad, you hang in there. Okay, I think that is all for Trade Talks. So, some acknowledgements. Thanks again so much to Douglas Irwin at Dartmouth, Petros Mavroidis at Columbia, and Alan Sykes at Stanford.
Thanks to them both for helping us to develop the episode and for their amazing book, The Genesis of the GATT. I urge everyone to go outside, turn on your phone, and buy a copy at an Amazon online bookstore near you. Oh, and also thanks to Doug for mentioning our joint research. We have this paper called GATT Tariff Levels Circa 1947. It's one of my favorite papers because I think it's the only time I've ever used the word circa in print.
Thank you to my choir, the Laycock Scholars, for recording really weird versions of Happy Birthday. And to you, we would be super, super grateful to our listeners if you left us a really nice review on iTunes. Apparently, there's some kind of Apple algorithm thing that means that it's important.
Tell your friends, tell people at the gym, your dog walking buddies, say to them, hey, you talking to me? Why are you talking to me? You shouldn't be talking to me. You should be listening to this podcast, Trade Talks.
If you have specific feedback or ideas for future episodes, then do get in touch. I'm at Samaya Keynes.
And I'm at Chad Bown.
And we're on at @trade_talks.
That's not one, but two underscores, @trade_talks.
Because listening to just one clip of Samaya's choir was not enough.
Happy birthday, dear Geraldine, Tom's Harris and Trade.
Happy birthday, Gat.